This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and you are joining us in the midst of a crisis which seems to be at a real historical turning point. The crisis in Ukraine and Crimea may be deceptively serious or deceptively of little consequence. At this fork in the road, we need to examine this hour two very different perspectives on the crisis, help you to understand the traditional ethnic players on the ground in eastern Ukraine, and then look at the big power stakes, the U.S., Europe, and especially China, on the sidelines, uneasy sidelines, yet with crucial ties and investments that may make disengagement difficult over the next few weeks. We'll also focus this hour closer to home on your home and how the value of it may be the most important economic indicator for communities struggling to break free of the global recession. But we begin with the Russian perspective on this crisis. We turn now to Dmitry Babich. He's political analyst for the Voice of Russia Radio, joins me now from Moscow. Dmitry, welcome back to the program.
Yes, nice to hear from you.
So a couple of things. Let's begin with the idea that was reported fairly widely yesterday that it is widely assumed in Russia, according to polling, that what happened in Ukraine is being thought of as a terrorist takeover in Kiev. Do you believe that, and why do most Russians seem to believe that?
Well, I can tell you my impression. I not only traveled in Ukraine, but I also read in Ukrainian and in other languages the program documents of some of the parties now represented in the Ukrainian government. One of them is called Svoboda, but in the beginning of the 90s, it was called the National Social Party of Ukraine, a euphemism for National Socialist. These people write that they are Ukrainians are, I quote, anthropologically and culturally superior to Russians. And they say they are the successors of the Ukrainian nationalists who helped in 1941 Adolf Hitler to take hold of Ukraine, of Western Ukraine, fighting the Soviet troops there. We all know very well that a lot of these people later served in the concentration camps. You probably remember the odyssey of John Demjanjuk, one of such people who was later deported from the United States to face justice. As a friend of mine in Kiev said, this revolution was anti-corruption, anti-authoritarian, but also anti-Russian.
But is that a pretext for massing Russian troops on the border of Crimea and actions which seem to speak about some sort of liberation of Russian-speaking people in Crimea by the Russian army, by, in a sense, annexing Crimea? Are you prepared to say that the Russians are not planning to do anything like this?
Well, he talked about protecting these people from some of the elements in the new government in Ukraine. And of course, if this government is, you know, includes the people whom I just described from the National Social Party of Ukraine, if one of its first laws is the abolition of Russian as a regional language in 13 Ukrainian regions with predominantly Russian population, of course people in Crimea have reasons to be concerned. And that's why they supported, you know, the movement of troops, and there was not a single shot fired so far.
Although people we spoke with in Crimea yesterday say Russian-speaking and Ukrainians say that what they fear most is Russia getting involved and bringing Europe into this conflict and creating a much wider, much more escalated, you know, sense of violence throughout Ukraine. That's what they fear. They don't fear these extremist groups that you're talking about.
Well, I don't know which people you talk to, but I have a lot of friends in Ukraine, especially in eastern Ukraine. And why do you think we have now protest rallies, not only in Crimea, but also in Donetsk, in Kharkiv? Why do you have people there putting Russian flags at various places? You know, they want to defend themselves from the new nationalist government in Kiev.
But Vladimir Putin also signed an agreement not to move troops into Ukraine, into Crimea. And it would appear that the movement of troops has violated that agreement on the surface. What does Putin say to that?
Well, actually, the troops which moved in Crimea, these were the troops which were stationed there at the base of the Black Sea Fleet, according to an agreement signed years ago. You know, it was interesting today, Putin at this press conference, he said that when we described what happened in Kiev as a violent takeover of power, we hear in response that this is a people's revolution. Okay, Putin said, if it's a people's revolution, then it's a different country, just like the Soviet Union was a different country from the Russian Empire before 1917. If it's a different country, a revolutionary country, then the agreements that we have had with it are no longer valid.
So that is his basis for saying that he's followed international law in this, that basically the Ukrainian government has thrown out the rule book and we're starting from square one. So everything's legal.
All the sides here got out of the framework of the law. And in this situation, it's very difficult to say who started first and who is more at fault. But I would remind you that all of it started from a very minor problem. You know, Yanukovych just asked to postpone the signing of that association agreement with the EU. He didn't cancel it. He just wanted to postpone it. And then the EU got mad. You know, there was direct support for the insurgency in Kiev. And we are now with 10 times or 100 times greater problems than with this small, minor issue of the timing for signing an agreement with the EU.
Finally, Dmitry, would you say that Putin believes, that the Russians believe, and that you believe that the West has thrown in with anti-Semitic, anti-Russian extremists by supporting the protesters in Kiev?
Well, I think that John Kerry and Catherine Ashton and other Western diplomats, they should be more selective in the kind of people whom they shake hands with in Ukraine, with the kind of people that they support in Ukraine. So the truth is that this Ukrainian revolution was both anti-corruption and anti-Russian, and also partially even anti-Jewish.
Dmitry Babich is a political analyst for the Voice of Russia Radio, speaking to us from Moscow. Dmitry, thank you so much.
Thank you.
So what do the large number of Ukrainians and Ukrainian Americans in this country think of the situation in Crimea and of the divisions between Russia and Ukraine? Boris Potapenko is former president and current vice chair of the Ukrainian Congress Committee in Detroit. Boris, welcome.
Thank you.
What do you make of this language from Dmitry a moment ago about the kinds of people they shake hands with, referring to Secretary of State John Kerry, that the people running Ukraine right now are extremists, anti-Jewish, anti-Semites?
A U.S. representative to the United Nations yesterday characterized Russia's position on what's going on in Ukraine and who's in charge in Ukraine as black is white and white is black. And the Chancellor of Germany, Angela Merkel, characterized Mr. Putin's utterances as rather bizarre and that he has lost touch with reality. The fact that this canard about fascists, anti-Semites, nationalists is constantly being repeated by the Russian government and its fellow travelers around the world is really directed towards the Russian people. Because in the West, despite the drumbeat from Russia's associates or supporters in academia and media, the West has really come to understand that Maidan was a revolution for European values, that it was a revolution that was manned by different nationalities that called themselves Ukrainian citizens.
All right, Boris, but let's take the argument of Putin look at it from its political sort of power. Can he mobilize paranoid, fearful Russian-speaking people in Crimea and Ukraine by appealing to these, as you say, mad metaphors about anti-Semitism and fascism, and really deny the West an influence in this conflict?
No, he can't, because in Ukraine, the people live together. In eastern Ukraine especially, the Russian speakers are predominantly ethnic Ukrainians. Russians make up only 18% of the population, and there isn't a majority of Russians in any of the Ukrainian provinces. Moreover, the organized Jewish community in Ukraine is very upset with the use by Yanukovych and now by Putin of the term anti-Semitism to try to foment hostilities in Ukraine.
Can he foment? Can he make good on that fomenting? In other words, can all this stuff be stirred up?
No, the only way he could do that is by introducing larger numbers of Russian agents in Ukraine, if not the army itself.
All right, let's talk about Western influence here. John Kerry arrived in Kiev proposing a billion-dollar loan. Do you think that's enough, or is that a sort of paltry symbolic symbol at this point? The Russians already offered $8
billion. It's an important first step in a bridge loan for the transition government, so that in May, when the new government, the new president is elected and a new government is put in place, the IMF can renegotiate the repayment of its loan and introduce a new aid package. So right now, Ukraine needs a bridge loan for the next 3 months. That $1 billion is good towards a total of a $3 billion bridge loan at this time.
30 seconds, Boris. What are you most fearful of in the next coming days?
I'm very concerned that the 150,000 Russian troops, mobile offensive forces amassed along the eastern frontier of Ukraine, will cross into Ukraine. Russia really needs to make a decision whether it's made its point, or its point is to go back to 1921 when they invaded an independent Ukraine and started the whole process of five generations under Soviet rule.
Boris Potapenko is former president and current vice chair of the Ukrainian Congress Committee in Detroit. Thanks so much, Boris. The music there of Czech composer Leoš Janáček, the orchestral suite Taras Bulba, named for a Cossack hero. In this Ukraine crisis, we're hearing about Cossacks and Tatars, ethnic Russians and Slavs, and let's give you a very quick historical context right now for these formerly exotic and now historically relevant terms. Let's take the Cossacks first. They are an ancient people of southern Russia and southern Ukraine who became a national movement, helping to free the Ukrainians from Polish rule in the 17th century. Then they were a movement that fought to constrain Russian encroachment in Ukraine and other Slavic lands in modern times, especially during the Soviet Union. And they have been Russian backers and Russian enemies down through history. It is Russian Cossacks who have thrown in with the ethnic Russians in Crimea in the current crisis. Then there are the Tatars, an ancient Muslim people associated with the city of Kazan. That history evoked here by Russian composer Mussorgsky in the piece you're listening to now, Siege of Kazan, from the opera Boris Godunov. In the 18th century, a large group of Tatars settled in Crimea. The Tatars were ruthlessly suppressed under the Soviet Union under Joseph Stalin, but eventually were granted their own Republic of Tatarstan, a republic that did not make it as an independent nation after the fall of the Soviet Union. And so as we listen to the classic Great Gate of Kiev from Mussorgsky's Pictures at an Exhibition, Kiev and Ukraine have become the center of numerous ethnic and political grievances against Russia and against the various movements that would confront Moscow right now. Keeping them all in focus will be the challenge for the West, if it means to have any influence in these ancient places. This is The Takeaway. From Kiev to Capitol Hill now, there are some in the ideological spectrum in the United States who will miss not having Congressman Henry Waxman to anoint as the evil genius of the left wing of the Democratic Party. After this term, there will be no Congressman Henry Waxman to kick around anymore, to use an old Richard Nixon phrase. And that's appropriate because Waxman came in with the Nixon backlash Watergate class of 1974. He has represented the 33rd District in the state of California for four decades and has decided that this term will be his last. There are some like Big Tobacco and the fossil fuel industry who will no doubt be glad to see the Waxmeister say goodbye. He fought and won big battles to sanction or regulate those industries during his time in Congress. When he sat down recently with Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick, Congressman Waxman also wanted to remind his friends and enemies about how he was a pioneer in the battle to formulate an aggressive federal response to the AIDS crisis.
We heard about an epidemic that was affecting gay men in New York, L.A., and San Francisco. These men were dying of a very rare cancer called Kaposi's sarcoma. We didn't even know the word AIDS at that point. When we held our hearing in April 1982, over 30 years ago, there had been around 300 cases and 100 deaths. And what we also found was that the confirmed cases were doubling every month. And there were even hysterics at that time. Some people said the disease was casually transmitted by spores. Some people said it was being intentionally spread. There were magazine covers that said everyone was at risk. And then there were anti-gay zealots who used the disease to promote their hatred. There were fanatics who said AIDS was God's revenge. People called for quarantines, for branding and tattooing the people who were sick. But worst of all, in my view, there was apathy and silence. President Reagan wouldn't even say the word AIDS. He wouldn't even acknowledge the word or the epidemic.
Did you push on the White House at the time to increase funding or to at least give public voice to the disease, call attention to it?
We held hearings, at least 30 hearings after that first one, to draw attention to the issue. We were very fortunate that in the administration, the Surgeon General was C. Everett Koop, a very courageous man who said, this is a disease, we've got to fight it as a disease. We were able to increase the amount of money for research spent by the National Institutes of Health, and eventually we passed the Ryan White Care Act, which provides medical care and other essential services to people living with AIDS. We've come a long way since those days, but could you imagine in the beginning, not only was it a death sentence, but gay people and gay men and drug abusers, who were the primary groups that were getting HIV and AIDS, had no protection for their privacy, no protection against being discriminated against, and they would lose their jobs, they'd lose their health care, they'd lose their privacy and everything else.
Times have also changed, and the culture has changed around tobacco over the last 20 years. Mm-hmm. And people will remember in their mind's eye the tobacco CEOs standing up with their right hands and swearing to tell the truth about manipulation of tobacco and getting the public addicted and tobacco records and movies that came out of that. That was your committee. You were the chairman in front of whom they stood and lied.
The human face for the tobacco industry came across when we had the CEOs of the tobacco companies raise their right hand to promise to tell the truth and then immediately proceeded to tell us that cigarette smoking was not really harmful, that it wasn't really addictive. All of those statements turned out to be untrue. But after their testimony, the wall that they had erected over decades of keeping what they were doing quiet broke, and people were coming forward to say that the tobacco industry was doing a lot of research on how to make sure the nicotine levels were enough to addict kids. The CEOs were men in suits and stood there, lied, and profited from the only product that was legal, where if you use it as intended, it killed people. When people saw that this was something that was helpful to these corporate liars, they realized that they were being taken for suckers.
On another note, you have a long career as a liberal, as a progressive, a long voting record on things like minimum wage and unemployment insurance and single-payer health care. But you're leaving Congress at a time of not unprecedented, but certainly in the last two generations, unprecedented income inequality, where the middle class, at least in terms of their wages, is doing worse than they have since the 20s. I wonder if it pains you or feels like some work left undone to be leaving at a time when things aren't better for middle class and lower income folks. They're actually quite a bit worse.
I think we have to recognize that we're not keeping the American promise that if you work hard, play by the rules, you could succeed. Because a lot of people are being told that no matter how hard they work, they're not going to go very far. I feel very badly about that. I think, however, we have to keep in mind that the strength of this country is to have a middle class that's strong and growing, because otherwise we will have a permanent situation as we have now with a small group at the top and the middle class being pushed either up or down and mostly down.
What about regrets? Any time you end an era in your life and there's reflection, everybody has them. And I wonder what your biggest one or two are, professionally, personally, as a politician, accomplishments. What do you, now that you're leaving, what do you regret?
As the song goes, regrets, I've had a few, too few to mention. So I'm not going to mention them.
Anything left unaccomplished that you would love two more years to try to do?
Well, the unfinished business, as I see it, is dealing with the climate change issue. This is a huge threat to our planet, certainly to our nation. We're already seeing the impact of climate change and storms and hurricanes and droughts. And scientists are overwhelmingly telling us, unless we do something about this, in 15 years, the amount of greenhouse gases that will accumulate in the atmosphere will mean that we won't be able to reverse it. And the amazing thing to me is that the people in charge of the House of Representatives deny the science. Luckily, President Obama is taking a lot of this on with his own administration under current law. He needs the support of the American people.
Congressman, thank you so much. Congressman Henry Waxman.
You're welcome.
Speaking of planetary science, what goes around comes around, right? Planets orbit, comets come around for a return visit, galaxies, all billions and billions of them, rotate or expand in this constantly moving universe. That's how it works in the cosmos, and that is how it works on television, apparently, where this weekend, a comet of science and entertainment will make a return visit from a long hiatus. Cosmos 2014, the new television series.
This is the cosmos. A network of 100 billion galaxies. And it's the greatest story science has ever told.
An exuberant astrophysicist, Neil deGrasse Tyson, host of Cosmos 2014, which will revisit the passion and evangelical energy of the late Carl Sagan about science, about the unknown, and about humanity's quest for understanding what Tyson called there the greatest story ever told. With some sophisticated production values, mind you. In many ways, the return of the Cosmos series is the return of the intellectual comet, Carl Sagan. He believed that the future was all about understanding science, and we wonder what he would make of the world today. Would he go on Jimmy Fallon as much as he went on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson? What would he make of seeing so many of the benefits of science everywhere around us, from digital tools to the much more sophisticated science fiction movies of today to real educational initiatives like the online Khan Academy and the just-announced World Science University from young cosmologist and Columbia professor Brian Greene?
When you learn things, you're always trying to build in your mind some visual imagery of abstract ideas. That's the challenge of learning science. And if we can provide rich visualizations that allow the student to enter the strange world of the quantum, or the strange world of moving fast, or the strange world of general relativity where gravity is strong, wow! Then all of a sudden you get it in your bones, and that's very different.
What would Dr. Sagan make of our different world today? Would he feel better about our educational system than he did in this interview with our PRI colleague and Science Friday host Ira Flatow back in the summer of 1996?
Something dreadful happens to students between first and 12th grades, and it's not just puberty. The interest in science, which is there in first grade, is somehow beaten out of them by 12th grade. And I think part of it is that there are adults who are nervous about being asked penetrating questions by young people, and so they give off-putting answers. You know, why is the moon round? Well, what did you expect it to be, square? Instead of encouraging the child, it's a deep question, why is the moon round? It can get to the nature of gravitation, of central forces, the strength of materials. There's so much in there if you wanted to pursue it. And likewise, all those other wonderful questions that kids ask. Why do we have toes? What's the birthday of the world? How deep could you dig a hole? And so on. Every one of those is an aperture to exciting children, their natural aptitude and interest in science, exciting that, and encouraging them not necessarily to be professional scientists, but to be citizens who have a responsible role in dealing with science. We have a society based on science and technology, and at the same time have arranged things so that almost no one understands science and technology. That's a prescription for disaster as clear as anything.
The late Carl Sagan's legacy has been to be a scientific mentor for the world, inspiring generations of young scientists, including Brian Greene and new Cosmos host Neil deGrasse Tyson. Dr. Sagan certainly inspired me. How about you? Who is your Carl Sagan science mentor today? Do you have a Sagan story from years ago? You'll hear more from some of those behind the making of the new Cosmos program in the coming days on The Takeaway. Our number is 877-8-MY-TAKE. And all of the billions and billions of you out there should send us a tweet, too. You just use the hashtag SaganStory. It was the best of times and the worst of times, you'll recall, at the beginning of Dickens' A Tale of Two Cities. For the two cities in the U.S. we are going to look at now, it may be neither of those, Spokane in western Washington and Lafayette in Indiana. These two neither large nor small communities have dodged the worst of the recession, are bouncing back economically, but are still challenged by an identity problem as they deal with a changing economic base. John Garisco is the executive manager at MDI Marketing in Spokane, Washington, and Mark Dolfini is the owner of June Palms Property Management in Lafayette, Indiana. Dolfini says that housing tells the story in his town. Rents, mortgages, and prices have all come down out of the clouds, and that's good.
It sounds like this is a tale of two cities. It's funny because I think this is a very normal market. You know, anything that's priced well, that's priced appropriately, will sell, and it sells quickly.
Well, normal, except that we've just come out of a recession that really put people on the sidelines. Do either of you have a sense that there's some folks still on the fence who might come off, who are accessible to the markets in either of your communities? Spokane, John?
We're definitely trending up. We're back to where I feel like we probably were, you know, in the early 2000s. But it didn't take long before people were really right back into the economics of purchasing homes in our market.
And Mark, how would you say the rental situation is in terms of the possibility that there are people out there who have really been demoralized by this recession who still haven't reentered?
The way that I look at it is rents tend to be a leading economic indicator for how housing is going to start selling. But I think that this has really demoralized a lot of people, to use your word, where these people were in a job for 10, 12, 15 years that they thought that this is a job that they were going to stay in. And then they got the legs knocked out from underneath them, and they didn't go right back into the rental market. You know, after they lost their homes, they were doubling up on couches. They were living in other places. And as bad as the housing market was, it was terrible in the rental market. So I think what's happening here is now that these people are looking at their options for housing, they feel comfortable to rent because they know it's a very fluid situation.
Has the recession changed the economy in either of your communities in some fundamental way? And can you see that reflected in the way housing prices and the housing market is working, John?
Yeah, you know, I mean, we weren't completely untouched from what happened. So we were seeing probably some beautiful properties that were quite a bargain, and they still tend to be. The prices, you know, have gone up. We haven't recaptured probably the full 30% loss, but, you know, we've probably got about half of that back so far. So things have made the turn, and the money is starting to really flow into the economics here in Spokane. Here's where we had a little bit of a bubble. The gold rush was in mortgages and real estate and in the car business. And those are probably the three industries that were affected the most, which isn't the biggest industries. Our big industry here in Spokane is Fairchild Air Force Base and the health science and hospital area. So that has always kind of kept us a little bit in the bubble.
And Mark Dolfini in Lafayette, Indiana, what has changed in the economy in your community?
We always had very historically low unemployment, but Lafayette has so much industry. There's Wabash National, there's Caterpillar, there's Nanshan Aluminum, but there was a significant number of people that were coming here because of, again, like the Subaru Isuzu plant, they were expanding operations and they were looking for more people, and 200 new jobs just moved into that area. That means 200 families need places to live.
Well, then before we go, if we think about the future and housing prices, would you say that the economy and the recession has created new inequalities in your community, that there's a different cast of characters inhabiting those various groups, John?
Yeah, there's definitely a different cast of characters. And I got to go back to the tale between two cities, because the current folks here who had some of the main industries before what I would say larger industries came to the area, their stories were a little bit bleak when it came to commercial development. So we're growing from folks from outside the area. We're seeing a whole line of new businesses. And as Mark said, you're bringing hundreds, if not thousands, of new families to the area.
Trendline up in Spokane. John Garisco, thanks so much. He's executive manager at MDI Marketing, a local firm that works with Spokane businesses. Thanks so much, John.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And Mark Dolfini is owner of June Palms Property Management in Lafayette, Indiana. Mark, thanks so much.
It's my pleasure. Thanks so much.
So in Spokane and Lafayette there, we sort of audio clicked on those two cities and heard a lot of detail about how in their communities the sense of well-being is tied very closely to their sense of the value of houses and homes. Well, there's a way for you to do that in visual data form using a tool from the Demand Institute, starting with the assumption that the behavior of local housing markets coupled with income and employment data together can be powerful predictors of local and national economic conditions. They've produced a map. I mean, that just makes good sense, right? Well, what makes even more sense is to actually take a look at this data in the map format presented by the Demand Institute. Joining us now is Louise Keeley, Chief Research Officer for the Demand Institute, co-author of the report on economic conditions around the country. Louise, welcome.
Hi.
So you're calling this a tale of 2,000 cities, in a sense. Is that the number of cities that you looked at, or is it even more than that?
We looked at 2,200 cities and towns in the U.S. All of these towns are incorporated with populations of 15,000 or more in 2011. And we looked at a range of variables related to housing and other indicators of community well-being in each of them.
And housing stands out as a major indicator, but it's certainly not the only one. And you've divided all of these cities of 15,000 population and above into nine categories: affluent, metro, boroughs, or metro burbs, cosmopolitan suburbs, traditional suburbs. Go down the list, and if you can blurb me a characteristic that describes these nine categories.
Sure. So we looked at this data and we developed nine community profiles across the U.S. from the most successful communities to the most struggling. So starting with our affluent metro burbs, the most successful, these are the most affluent, wealthiest communities, both in terms of income as well as in terms of home prices. These tend to be small, very densely populated cities that are sometimes nearer to larger metropolitan areas. And in some ways, these places provide an ideal mix of urban living and suburban living, so many of the amenities of urban living, but without some of the challenges. The next two segments or profiles are suburban, our cosmopolitan suburbs, and our traditional suburbs. Cosmopolitan suburbs are also very affluent, very high rates of home ownership. And these are some of the fastest growing places in the U.S. Some of these places literally grew over 1,000% between 2000 and 2012. But they just have a very suburban feel. Traditional suburbs, also high rates of homeownership, relatively affluent, tend to be more stable in terms of the boom and the bust in home prices, and are more established suburban communities.
Communities the like Clive, Iowa. I'm actually playing with the map, and you can go to thetakeaway.org and play around with this map. It's actually quite fun. You can find your region. You can find the dense populations of affluent metro burbs next to traditional suburbs, the cosmopolitan fast-growing places that you describe. All right, what's a vacation retirement destination? That's the next category.
So these are places. They tend to be in the Sun Belt. They're warmer weather. And there are places where people go on vacation, as well as the kind of the cliche of people retiring to Florida. There are these types of places. These places saw big rises and big falls in prices during the housing boom and the housing crisis.
Now, smack in the middle are the historic skyline cities. I suspect that's where I am in New York, right?
Yep. So historic skyline cities, these are the most densely populated places in the U.S. They include places like New York, Chicago, Philadelphia, but also some smaller cities that still are very densely populated and have a very urban feel to them, places like Providence, Rhode Island, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, that we highlight in the report. These are places that have lower income than our most successful community profiles, but still have a lot to offer to people who live there. They're relatively expensive, however, And and some of our oldest cities are there, too. These are some of our older cities.
And smack in the middle is traditional transitional cities, and we actually profiled two of those just a moment ago. And right at the bottom, I'll just finish the list for you, are deflated bubble communities, challenged communities, and endangered communities. These are places that are really having some trouble. A few words about transitional cities. Did they avoid the recession like our two characters from Lafayette and Spokane?
Yeah, the transitional cities in some ways are the most interesting group of cities. It's 377 cities, 39 million people live there. And, you know, when we look at the boom and the bust in prices, transitional cities actually had kind of the mildest rise and decline of many places. Relative to some places in the country, they did avoid the destabilizing effects of the housing crisis.
So with all due sort of concern for our neighbors in endangered communities and challenged communities and deflated bubble communities, I suspect the areas around Las Vegas would be places that would qualify as deflated bubble communities. What should we watch to gauge the general economic health of the nation? Or is it really a community-by-community picture at this point?
It's both. So I think the reason why we developed these profiles is so that one can get a quantified, clear sense of what the landscape is of communities across the country. But the reality is that every community has its own story. So if I look at endangered communities, these are the most struggling. These are places where population growth has been low or declining. Employment growth often is negative. Poverty rates are high. Incomes are low. So that's a general picture. But then the reasons why each community is in the situation it's in and what the possibilities are to bring it out and to bring it into a more successful course are going to vary community by community.
All right. The Louise Keeley, Chief Research Officer for the Demand Institute, co-author of this report called 2000 Cities, actually a survey of more than 2000 cities of population 15,000 or more. You can go to thetakeaway.org and see the map of economic prosperity in communities all across the nation. Louise, thanks so much.
Thank you.
So the story is different even in communities that are prosperous. From Everett, Washington, one of you writes, His house is a burden. 1924 Craftsman. Do you know what that is? Sears actually produced homes during much of the 20th century. And a 1924 Craftsman is the house that he bought. Lost $160,000 in 5 years due to market, and it still needed repairs. A lot of those Craftsman homes, those Sears homes, are still going strong. How does the value of your home help to determine the economic health of your community? Is your home a burden or is it an asset right now? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway. Back to Ukraine now, with Russia and China in apparent agreement on how to deal with the uprising in Ukraine, both adamantly opposed to Western intervention in this instance in the Crimea dispute and opposed to Western meddling in their internal affairs as a matter of principle. Are we seeing a new and fundamental divide between East and West right now? A divide that a billion-dollar loan offer from Secretary of State John Kerry can't even begin to bridge. Republican Senator John McCain blasted the U.S. administration even before the offer yesterday as being unprepared for this crisis.
This is a blatant act on the part of Vladimir Putin and one that must be unacceptable to the world community. It cannot stand.
Senator John McCain invoking principle there, speaking to AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, the powerful lobby that apparently harbors few concerns about the alleged anti-Semitic nature of the new regime in Kiev, allegations we heard at the top of this program from Dmitry Babich in Moscow. So what about this idea of a 21st century bipolar world? We call on Jonathan Fenby, China director of the research company Trusted Sources. His new book is called Will China Dominate the 21st Century? Jonathan, welcome back.
Thank you.
Also with us is Timothy Snyder, professor of history at Yale University, author of Bloodlands, Europe Between Hitler and Stalin. Professor Snyder, welcome.
Glad to talk to you.
So, Jonathan Fenby, China's involvement here in Ukraine, it's way over $1 billion, and it in some ways informs the Chinese reaction to this crisis. How do you see it?
Well, I think China's reaction is quite complicated in this. I mean, first of all, China had built up some quite strong economic links with the Ukraine under the previous regime there. It buys weapons from Ukraine, and it made big investments in farmland, which Ukraine's got a lot of, and China needs the wheat and needs the grain and needs the food from there. And they had the former president of Ukraine on a red carpet trip to Beijing a few months ago. So they were quite invested in the old regime. And that makes their present position difficult. We don't know quite what those economic links are going to be. But then on top of that, China hates the idea of any country intervening in the internal affairs of another country. And that is partly self-defensive. And of course, in this case, it's interesting. It doesn't, I don't think, see Vladimir Putin as intervening, but it sees the West as meddling in a way that it shouldn't do and China doesn't want to do. But at the same time, it probably is a bit leery of throwing all its weight behind Moscow at this point because there are differences between Moscow and Beijing.
A real dilemma. But Timothy Snyder, I'm wondering if we could expand on that. China and Russia have survival reasons, internal survival reasons for suppressing ethnic minorities and various groups inside their country to maintain their prosperity. In the case of Russia, because of oil, in the case of China, because of its rapidly expanding industrial sector, that's very different from the West. Are you seeing a fundamental division between East and West here, where Russia and China have their own views on how to deal with internal conflicts, and the West is spouting all of these John McCain-esque principles?
I think the leadership in Russia now has finally clarified its own new anti-Western ideology, and I think that has a great deal to do with why it is invading Ukraine. Putin, after a long time thinking, has decided that he is going to be the defender of right-wing, socially conservative values. That means the oppression of sexual and ethnic minorities. It means the definition of Russia as a cradle of a kind of special civilization. Now, this is related to the general conflict because, as you say, both the Americans and the Europeans tend to make their arguments in terms of principles, whether those are principles of human rights or principles of national sovereignty. Whereas Putin seems to have shifted to a different kind of argumentation altogether, where he regards those things as empty facades, and the only things that truly matter are the deep, immutable, and in a way undescribable values of Russian culture. I have to comment in this connection on the way you closed the introduction with the anti-Semitism, because this is very important. Its attempt to claim that the current Ukrainian government is anti-Semitic is outrageous. The Ukrainian prime minister is Jewish. The governors of eastern regions are Jewish. Jews took part in the protests and the revolution which overturned the past government. And the past Ukrainian regime used anti-Semitism against the protesters because some of them were Jewish. That claim is an attempt to put the entire debate on the wrong track. It doesn't reflect reality at all. All it reflects is Kremlin propaganda.
Well, trying to see the reality here from all of the propaganda on all sides here, and we heard from a Ukrainian American who was also outraged by the anti-Semitic charges of our Russian speaker at the top of the program. Jonathan Fenby, do the Russians and the Chinese have a pragmatic interest in maintaining their control over these ethnic minorities within their countries? And does that alone divide them from the West?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, in China, you've got two huge territories in the west of China, Tibet and Xinjiang. And the populations, the original populations of those two territories are not Han Chinese at all. They're Tibetan or Uyghur Muslims. And China has, it's an article of faith in China that those two territories are part of China. They are essential to Chinese unity. And we've had confrontations, clashes in Tibet. More than 100 Buddhist monks and nuns have burnt themselves to death since 2009, and around the world there's been hardly a murmur of attention to that at all. And in Xinjiang, we have repeated clashes, maybe 200 a year there. And of course, just last weekend, a group of people in black uniform went on a rampage with swords and machetes at a railway station in southwest China, and officials there have linked that with what the Chinese say are separatist, fundamentalist, al-Qaeda-linked terrorists from Xinjiang. So this is a very, very important issue for the Chinese.
For both of you on the way out here, then, I'm wondering if the West, and particularly the United States, you know, have they climbed into a bit of a conundrum here in that The situation in Iraq and Afghanistan, as seen by the leadership in China and Russia, makes it very difficult for the U.S. to stand on principle on questions of non-intervention. So we're seeing in this Ukraine crisis a consequence of the invasion of Iraq on some level. Timothy Snyder and then Jonathan Fenby.
Look, I opposed the war in Iraq from the very beginning, and it was wrong for all of the reasons that I opposed it then.
But is it harder for the U.S. to stand on that precise principle because of the problems?
No, it's not any harder because Putin is totally indifferent to the principle anyway. The principle means absolutely nothing to him. Nevertheless, it's a principle which I think we are right to try to support. Whatever instruments work on Mr. Putin, they're not going to be about insisting on principles. Of that, we can be pretty sure.
Jonathan Fenby, can Putin exploit a sense of U.S. and Western hypocrisy on these questions of principle post-Iraq, post-Afghanistan?
Well, he'll try to do so, and that particularly, I think, in Europe. And, of course, a lot depends here on the reaction of the Europeans and particularly of Germany. And you have latent anti-Americanism, certainly in Europe, which can be whipped up without a great deal of difficulty. And as for China, the truth is that Chinese foreign policy is all over the place, and this leaves it somewhat dangling in limbo here, and I think pretty uncertain what to do over Ukraine and whatever may come out of that between Russia, the U.S., and the European Union.
Well, gentlemen, thanks for a fascinating discussion here at the end of our hour. Jonathan Fenby is China director of the research company Trusted Sources. His new book, Will China Dominate the 21st Century? Speaking to us from London. Thanks, Jonathan.
Thank you.
And our gratitude to Timothy Snyder, professor of history at Yale University, author of Bloodlands, Europe Between Hitler and Stalin, speaking to us from Vienna, Austria. Professor Timothy Snyder, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Join the conversation. What principles do you think are at stake in this crisis in Ukraine? And talk about your house. Is it a burden or an asset? My house is a burden, writes one of you from the Bronx. It prevents me from taking a new job out of state. Join the conversation at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.